House Committee on Business and Labor. And the first thing I'm going to mention is we are not, and I forgive me if anyone's here for this reason, we are not going to have a work session on House Bill 2488 for the purpose of moving it to Judiciary Committee, because we're just going to keep that bill in this committee. And I apologize to anybody who showed up for that. Things change rather rapidly here sometimes, but we do our best. So I hope there's understanding and forgiveness if anybody showed up specifically for that bill. But we will be having a hearing on it. I hope nobody came 100 miles or more for that. So, Teresa, do I need anything?
No, Mr. Chair, that's it.
Explanation on that. Very good. And I'm just going to open a work session for the introduction of legislative concepts at this time, too. Teresa, you want to explain?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have four concepts in front of you. LC 2758 relating to public employee retirement. LC 2760 also relating to public employee retirement. LC 2761 relating to injured workers. And LC 3246 relating to motor vehicle consignments.
Thank you. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I move that the committee accept LCs 2758, 2760, 2761, and 3246 as committee bills.
Representative Barton moves the introduction of legislative concepts 2758, 2760, 2761, and 3246 as committee bills. Is there any discussion? And once again, members, for the record, this does not commit you to yes or no in this committee or any other committee or on the floor on these. We're just simply going through the process of creating a bill. Is there any comments, discussions, or concerns or opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. And then, just going right down the line, Teresa.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2540.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2540 repeals a statute which excludes the payment of unemployment insurance tax for for-profit persons or organizations that engage the services of musicians when operating under a proper contract. Members, on your preliminary staff measure summary, I made a mistake. We do have a fiscal analysis on it. There's no fiscal. We are waiting for the revenue impact. And I do have a copy, because the bill, as you can see, just states that the statute is repealed. But in your summary, I have printed out the actual statute for your reference.
Thank you. And I have Bruce Fife and Coke and Jim Rundberg. Am I saying that right? Well, come on up, folks. Ann, are you out there? Oh, there you are. Thank you. Come on up. And then right after that, I'll have Mike Bennett come up and speak to you. So whoever wants to go first, please go right ahead.
You should go first.
And introduce yourself for the record and go right ahead.
Good morning. My name is Ann Cook. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon at Machenbacher and Blattner. I got involved with this bill. I represent Mississippi Studios. This is Jim Brunberg, the owner of Mississippi Studios. Mississippi Studios was recently audited by the Employment Department, and so that's how I became intimately involved with this issue. And the how this relates to 506 and how we got here is the Employment Department took a look at every payment that was made to musicians by the venue, and based on 506, held that every musician that had ever played at the venue was an employee, and regardless of whether that musician, and the majority of the musicians who had played at Mississippi Studios had played there one time, were national, international acts that don't live in Oregon, have never been back to Oregon to play, and so the issue went in front of the Attorney General. The OED sought the AG's opinion on the application of 506. In the past, they would apply 657040, which is that which applies that independent contractor analysis, and the Attorney General held that because of the existence of 506, that they were not required to even look at 040 and apply independent contractor analysis. So essentially, what's happening with 506 is that merely because it exists, if there isn't a contract, number one, and a contract with specific language requirements that I'll go into detail about, that the musicians are automatically deemed employees of the venue, period. It doesn't matter who the musicians are, whether they're independent contractors or not. And so when this happened, and so Jim was stuck with the bill of paying for unemployment tax on all these musicians, we put a committee together of some industry folks and attorneys and Mr. Fife here from the union to look at what could be done. Is this, what is the practical effect and application of this law? Does an exemption need to be drafted? Does it need to be amended? And in researching other states and looking at this law, our consensus was that the simplest and most straightforward approach was to repeal the statute. And so I'm going to go into some reasons why it should be repealed. So the purpose of the bill first, I see there's two major purposes of this bill. We want to prevent inequitable and inconsistent application of independent contractor law to musicians and to the people who hire them. And second, we want to prevent further harm to the entertainment industry, namely venues and bars and restaurants, people who hire musicians, but also managers and agents and people and middlemen who are basically getting, who are having 506 applied to them because of the language in the statute. And so managers and agents who sign contracts on behalf of bands are now being deemed employers of these bands. So why 506 needs to be repealed? As I mentioned, first of all, the Attorney General has decided that because of the existence of the law, again, they don't even need to look at independent contractor analysis. They can say, unless there's a contract with the specific contractual wording required. And what that is there has to be wording in the contract. You can't just say, because I draft a lot of independent contractor agreements in my practice, and we'll usually say, the independent contractor represents that they're an independent contractor, or they're not an employee, or that they'll pay their own taxes. And that's been held to not be sufficient. Just having a contract in place isn't enough. Just having a statement that they're an independent contractor, they have to have a specific statement that they will report and pay all taxes. I had a woman who contacted me, who she had language in her contract that said the musician will report all taxes, and the OED said that wasn't sufficient because it had to say report and pay all taxes. And then second, the person who signs the contract on behalf of the band is then deemed the employer of the band, and unwittingly so most of the time. So unless there's a contract with that specific language included, then the musicians are deemed employees, period. There's no further analysis done. There's no case-by-case analysis of whether this musician actually is or isn't an independent contractor. So the other issue that comes in is this law was brought in the 80s, and the intent was to clarify this issue because the musicians often don't meet this direction, free from direction and control test, which I'll address. But in current industry practice, most venues, and especially the bigger venues in Portland, they don't draft their contracts. The majority of contracts are drafted by booking agents who, 99% of the time, don't even live in Oregon. And so the venues most often aren't even involved in the contracting process. So you have venues that are being held responsible for these unemployment taxes when they even, half the time, you haven't even seen or drafted the contract. And the contracts are being drafted by out-of-state people who don't even know that this law exists. And that was, the case with Mississippi Studios. Because of the drafting of the statute, first of all, it says it applies to anyone who engages the services of a musician. So that applies to any musical performance in the state of Oregon, whether you've got like in a venue situation, literally would be applied to like block parties, weddings. I mean, you name the whoever hires a musician is subject to this requirement, and so to expect that in every single circumstance where you have a performance, that you're A, going to have a contract, and B, that you're going to have a contract that meets the 506 language requirements, is I think, somewhat unreasonable. So a lot of people are kind of unwittingly being, this law is being applied to them, and they don't even know that it's out there. But the other thing that I mentioned, at the very end of that statute, the wording says that, let me pull that out. The last sentence in 506 says, the musician or musicians who sign a written contract designating as a responsible shall, for purposes of this chapter, be considered the employer of any musician performing services under the contract who did not sign the contract. So you have musicians who are signing on behalf of the band, who now all of a sudden are being deemed employers of the rest of the band. Or like I mentioned, I've been contacted by a bunch of managers and agents who are now being stuck because, as I mentioned, with the way the industry works with contracts, so often the booking agents will sign the contracts. The band itself very rarely actually signs the contract. And so now you have agents that are being held employees of the band. And so there's a... it's our opinion that basically the resulting effect of this law is that it doesn't fulfill the original intent. It was drafted to clarify the independent contractor issues, but unfortunately, the independent contractor analysis falls outside of what's happening with this law. Bruce will probably speak to you about the direction and control issue and independent contract, concerns about whether musicians qualify as independent contractors. Unfortunately, today, we're just looking at the narrow issue of whether 506 should be repealed. The issue of whether musicians qualify as independent contractors is actually basically a separate question. To be honest, a separate exemption probably should be drafted. Many musicians would qualify under the independent contractor test. But yeah, there are situations where a musician is told where to go and when to go and what to play and might not meet that free from direction and control requirement. The committee that we formed, could possibly address this issue for a future session. But the question at hand today is whether 506 should be repealed. And we should look at if 506 stays on the books, what that means. And so again, you've got a situation where independent contractor analysis is moot because of the existence of 506. You have to have a contract that has a specific language in there. And it's not that restaurants and venues, et cetera, don't use contracts. Many do. It's just that, in my experience, all of them don't meet the language requirements of 506. So even if you do have a contract, you're often stuck under the law anyway, then all of a sudden you have all these musicians who are your employees who maybe played at your venue once in a year or, some situation like that. So in our experience, the venues and people who've been audited have been very harmed by this law. Jim will speak to his experience with that. The Aladdin Theater in Portland is being audited right now, and it said that, based on the amount of money that they, for the number of years they're being audited, they, it could shut down their business because now all of a sudden, everyone that's ever played at the Aladdin Theater over the course of 4 years is being, they're having to pay taxes on these people. I know of no opposition to this bill. We've received a lot of support. I unfortunately do not have letters on me, but would be happy to provide those in the next few days if you would like those. Between Mississippi Studios, Aladdin Theater, Hawthorne Theater, Holocene, all the major venues in Portland, I've been contacted by Jimmy Max, all kinds of bars. The owner of Les Schwab Amphitheater called me to pledge his support. I've had several restaurants call me, Montage, Detour Cafe, just from really small little places to the Les Schwab Amphitheater. So as far as venue owners and bar and restaurant owners are concerned, they really want to see this statute go away. And again, any concern about whether musicians qualify as independent contractors or not is a separate question for another day that I think we should address, but is not the issue at hand today.
Thank you, Ann. Don't go anywhere. I want you staying right there.
Okay. And I have a handout to you if you
Great. Give it to the nice person over there because you got to handle this. I want you to stay right there. I want one of you nice men to get up and give your seat to Representative Shields, and he's going to testify on behalf of his bill, and then you can come back up.
Thank you for your time.
And my pleasure. We all feel stuck under the law sometimes. And I just want a couple comments before Representative starts.
Here you go.
It sounds like B.B. King has been an employee in the state of Oregon.
Correct.
And then my wife and I got married in 1990, and we violated the law because we did not.
Yeah, me too.
And then I have a friend, Rich. I won't say his last name, but I hope he watches this. He's a bass player in a band, and he's beyond all control and direction. Anyway. Anyway,
like
with that, Representative, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland, which includes the Alberta District and Mississippi District as well, home to some great musicians like Danny East and Little Sue, as well as people who come, large-scale musicians who come through from time to time, like John McCune of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who plays at places like Mississippi Studios. If there's one thing I've learned in this business is when there's no opposition, you should get out of the way and quit talking before...
Thank you, Representative, pointing that out.
Before I talk you into killing the bill. So I will step out of the way, let Jim and the others tell their story, and then we'll move on, and hopefully we can pass this to the floor. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you very much. And, Representative, we don't have a revenue impact statement, so we won't be working it today. But I have intention to move it. Good bill, it should pass. Thank you. So whoever wants to go next?
I want to go next.
Very good.
I'll try to be really brief. It sounds like even though we're in the Capitol building, we shouldn't talk for a long time. My name is Jim Brumberg. I was a touring musician for about 20 years, and then I decided the touring wasn't the life for me, so I settled down and opened a music venue in Portland, but I still work as a musician. I play in three bands, and I've played every kind of venue from the Rose Garden to Meadowlands to Joe's Garage down the street, and everything for the last 25 years of my life, and I've never been treated as an employee, so I was really surprised when the OED audited me and told me that I was the second largest employer in Portland, basically, and that I had thousands of employees, ranging from the band REM to Ricky Lee Jones to everybody I'd ever cut a check to. And the reason that I cut checks to people is because I own a building where concerts are held, and at the end of the night, my staff gathers all the ticket money, and because of a contract that's been drawn up by the artist's agent, as Ann pointed out, because of that contract that's been drawn up by an out-of-state agent, and due to the terms in that contract, we give the designated percentage of the ticket sales to the artist. The rest of it covers our expenses. We are basically a shell. We don't tell the artists when to play. We don't tell them what date to play. The date is based on their routing, wherever they're going to be passing through Portland. We don't tell them when they're set, what songs to play, what to wear, what instruments to play. We have no control, as you pointed out, over the artists. So by any analysis that I was ever aware of, these are independent contractors. So I was surprised to hear of the existence of a statute that singled out musicians to say that musicians, no matter what, except if you have this specific language that's in the statute, that musicians are de facto employees of the venues in which they play, because like I said, we had no control. And as a musician, I always prided myself, and still do, on being uncontrollable. They're not going to tell me what to wear, what to play, when to play, how loud to play, what guitar to use, anything like that. I'm playing in the house that they own, the hall that they own, but at the end of the night, they don't have any control over me. And I don't expect them to take any responsibility for my actions. And I don't want to unwittingly have there be this law in the books that, from a musician's perspective, ends up being basically a 4 or 5% tax that just gets levied on the entire industry because... venues, not myself, not as a venue owner, I wouldn't take advantage of this law, but other venues would say, oh, well, we got to pay your employment taxes, so we're going to just take another 5% off the top. So just put that aside to pay your employment taxes at the end of the year. So no musician wants to see that. I think I've explained about the lack of control that venues have over musicians. So if you do any sort of normal independent contractor analysis, you'll end up seeing that musicians are independent contractors in most situations. Bruce may point out some exceptions to that. That I personally haven't been a part of, but some people who play weeklies for a restaurant in which everything is controlled and they have to wear a uniform or something might be considered employees. But that for the concert venues that have been audited, myself, Mississippi Studios, Aladdin Theater, and Hawthorne Theater, these are mostly touring musicians, and the local bands that play there are just really putting on a concert in a place as opposed to working for the venue. I think that's probably all I have to add.
Before we move on to you, yes, we do limit how much time you can talk because we have a lot of work to do, but no one in this place wants to limit your artistic expression. Go ahead, sir.
Bruce Fife, President, Musicians Union, Local 99.
obviously I'm here to speak on behalf of the musician side of this story. And it's important to point out that this is a vastly diverse and creative industry, both in the product that we put out and the means that we do business. On one hand, we have the Oregon Symphony that is a straight-up employer-employee relationship, operates in a fashion that I think most of us are very familiar with. But then on the other hand, we have a musician that might be playing at an establishment where the only money they make...
Wait a minute, sir. I'll call you up when it's time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I control that, too.
Sorry. Quite all right.
He's the employer.
Yeah, where the money they make is generated by one of their friends standing at the door collecting a cover charge and the tips that they make. And according to, you know, this situation that we're dealing here, the venue, you know, lets them use the space but pays them nothing. They get what they make at the door. And according to this rule, that venue is now the employer of this band. It just doesn't make any sense. And there are 100 different business models in between those two extremes. I mean, there are as many ways of doing business in this industry as there are people, practically. There's no doubt that the repeal of 506, ORS 657, 506, would benefit the venues hiring the musicians, although the summary from the Employment Department cast doubt on that in my mind. But in spite of their analysis, I know of no state that does not consider a single musician or band performing at a club on an arbitrary schedule to be anything other than an independent contractor. So if the removal of the statute allows more venues to support live music by not being held to this unreasonable rule, that's a good thing for the musicians. Where the benefit to musicians becomes less clear is exemplified with the experience of one of our members and his band. He is now being audited by OED under this current rule. I have talked to numerous attorneys, to accountants, to try to get some definitive definition of when a band leader is an employer of musicians or when it's just a partnership or some other business entity, and I get no consistent answer. Nobody can agree on at what point a band leader is an independent contractor and when, or when the side musicians that play with them are an independent contractors in addition. So in this person's experience, in this band experience, he has about 3 musicians that perform at each instrument that he is on call, because these musicians perform with many bands. They lead their own bands. They are not necessarily available. So he will call musician number 1 to play piano. If he's not available, he'll call musician number 2. He may not have his full band in place until a half hour before the actual performance. And yet in that case, some people will say, yes, he is an employer. Others will say, no, he's not. It's a partnership that comes together at the last minute for the benefit of all. But the problem is there is no consistent answer to this. And the actual definitions of independent contractor just are... we could all waste a lot of time, money, and energy trying to argue these distinctions. And we're not talking about a lot of money here going into the Employment Department. So it seems that no matter what happens to this bill, we have not really solved the issue, the real problem for musicians. This is what I do know, though, for sure. Regardless of whether the venues or band leaders get held responsible for playing into unemployment insurance, musicians will never be able to benefit from this safety net. As musicians, they make, they rarely make enough to realize enough money to actually benefit from the program by paying into it, no matter what the circumstances are. And because musicians are always looking for work, they will probably find just enough work to move them out of the system on any given week. If they get 1 or 2 jobs a week, they're not going to get any unemployment benefits anyways. So they're paying a very minimal amount into the system. They have no ability to actually recoup what's there. The question is, should OED be collecting on behalf of those that can never really benefit from the system anyways? The out-of-state musicians is a classic example. They're here for one night, they're gone. Why would we collect an unemployment insurance on them? They can never benefit from the system. Having said all this, I do support passage of HB 25, the passage of the repeal of HB 2540. But I was also asked that I understand that there's a work group that is working on independent contractor enforcement guidelines, and that maybe somewhere within that work group there's an ability to take a look at our industry and recognize that we operate in a fashion that is quite different. I think it's important to note that due to labor law, Taft-Hartley, supported by the courts in 1978, the Musicians Union cannot organize club musicians under normal labor law because they have been deemed by the federal government to be independent contractors. A union cannot organize independent contractors. So federal labor law has deemed them to be independent contractors. I think that we need to look at this situation from that standpoint. They do not have the same rights as the construction trades and the garment trades in this area. We need to recognize that in other aspects of the government. I think that it's really important to recognize that the entertainment industry is the hardest hit in a recession. It's the first to feel the effects and the last to come out of it, and that if we do not repeal this law, that an industry that is already constantly living on the edge, an industry that in Portland is internationally recognized, could be critically stifled or destroyed. Thank you.
And we don't want to do that. And just so you know, the independent contractor issue is a constant subject of discussion in this building, constantly dealing with it. And yes, we are going to look at it again. So I just reach out to you to keep an eye on that and come on down. Any question? You know where to find Representative Shields. Do you have any questions? Does the committee have any questions of these? Representative Thatcher, please.
I do, and I thank you. I can't remember your name.
Ann.
Ann, thank you. I think you mentioned that this the 506 section of ORS 657 was back from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is the agency just now applying this law and interpreting it this way and created a rule? It seems like we would have had this conversation many years before.
I think so. There's some case law from early in the 80s, and then all of a sudden I get a call from Jim, and I called every other entertainment lawyer in Portland and employment attorneys and everyone in the industry, and no one even knew this law existed.
Wow.
And so it's really just come up since the venues have been audited in the last year.
I can respond to that too also. You know, the business operated much differently in the 80s. I spent 25 years as a club musician, and much of the work that I did, I would go into a venue 5 nights a week. I could be there for anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months, 5 nights a week, and stay at the same venue. That is a relation, and that was not unusual at that time, and that was a relationship that existed in a number of places. But the industry has changed dramatically since then, and all of our contracts at that time had this language in them. But as the industry shifted and changed its manner of doing business, I mean, now you have many venues that have four bands playing in the same venue a night. They each play for an hour. They come in, there's turnover. That didn't happen in 1983. So the industry itself has moved way beyond how it operated then into a completely different paradigm, and that's why this no longer even has any relevance.
And we have the department in the built room. After Mr. Bennett testifies, I'm going to ask them to come up and respond to some of this stuff. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you go into a venue, you're under a contractual agreement. Do you not agree in that contract to have so many sets for such a lengthy period of time? Example, I'm thinking my wife was president of the Jazz Jubilee in Medford. For 15 years, she was on that board, and these people would come in and they would do A, B, C, D, different venue, different set, but they all had a contractual agreement that they would be there at such and such a time for a certain length period of time in order to meet that contract. Is that what we're talking about?
That's one of the... I can address that.
When you contract someone, do they not come in and say, okay, I will play so long on a certain night or whatever?
A lot of it depends on the type of music that you're talking about. With jazz and with sometimes music is used as background, at private events or in restaurants. So sometimes there is an agreement that there will be, it's a negotiated agreement between two independent contractors, again, who contract out for a certain amount of music to be had. Now, in a concert venue, like the ones that we're talking about, in the one that I am, Mississippi Studios is a concert venue, the artist decides exactly how long they're going to play. They tell us. They tell me. And this, I have my venue hat on now. So Ricky Lee Jones is coming. She wants to play at midnight for 45 minutes. Literally, this is what happened. She didn't want to play at 8 p.m. She wanted to play at midnight for 45 minutes. Okay. This is what she does. And then for that, we will give her 80% of the doors, and we will, how much do you want tickets to be, Ricky Lee? $50. Okay, then it'll be a $50 ticket, and you get, in order to work this out, we negotiate, we'll pay our expenses to have the heat on and to have somebody at the door taking tickets for you. We'll have to do this. So usually a band determines, you know, Bruce Springsteen, when he comes to town, plays for 4 hours, Neil Diamond for an hour and a half. It's the artist's choice to play the number of hours and number of sets and that they want to play. In most situations that I've encountered, there are, like I've said, where music is used as background in a restaurant, we want a certain number of hours of dining ambiance and we want it to be live piano entertainment. That's a different type of thing. And as I've mentioned, that may be looking into more of the examples that Bruce is talking about, in which there should be an accurate analysis, an 040 analysis applied, or whatever.
So the answer to your question is sometimes. Sometimes that does happen.
But
what I'm saying is according to this rule, you can't apply, you can't look at what the specifics are and say this is how it needs to operate. It's determined by whether there is a written contract or not, which there is not always a written contract on jobs.
Yeah, they're not even looking at the relationship. I mean, first of all, there's such a variety of different types of performances, as these guys have both said, that every contract is so different depending on what type of venue, what type of musician, what type of situation, whether it's a wedding or it's the, you know, Crystal Ballroom. Those are just two very different situations and very different contracts. But this 506 prevents the OED from even looking at those questions. Again, so that's why, as much as we do need to address the issues of, well, hey, what type of situation is this? Is it dictating, you know, how much the musician plays? Unfortunately, those are questions outside of this current issue, because 506 merely says there's a contract, it has to have the specific language. If it doesn't, boom, you're an employee, period. There's no other analysis performed.
Jim, do you have a follow-up?
No.
Does that answer your question?
No.
Okay. Well, Representative Witt, did you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a technical question. I just wondered when Ricky Lee Jones was coming to town.
She'll be back. Don't have anything scheduled. When she wants to. That's the answer.
Is there any?
Any further questions of this nice panel here? Very good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bennett, please
come on up and shed your wisdom on this issue. And Tom, if you want to come up, or you want to come up and talk about it after Mr. Bennett, please. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Mike. Excuse me. My name is Mike Bennett. In a past life, I was worked for a consulting firm for unemployment matters, and was actually a registered lobbyist in the state as well as the state of Washington. I had forgotten all about this in the early 80s, and then about 22 years ago, we went through this change in the state of Washington and actually changed the definition up there, so musicians are exempt, similar to what we're talking about here. I also, in the past, have been approached by a couple of friends of mine who are touring musicians, and they had lost their concert promoter here in Portland, and asked if I would be willing to go into a partnership with them to do that. Thank goodness, after hearing all of these stories, it was not a promoter relationship. We actually had a partnership, and they had a federal employee ID number. They paid all their taxes. I paid all my taxes. But I'm here today to tell you how much it hurts other people. As part of that agreement, we did two concerts at the Aladdin, and all of the proceeds after taxes went to a Portland-based charity organization, the Children's Shelter of Hope Foundation, which takes care of a
home for abused children in Puerto Vallarta. As a result of that, I've had other musicians from that area that would like to come up here. And then in researching this whole problem, we found that they can't, because the extra taxation, the extra paperwork, I'm a sole proprietor in this venture, I couldn't do it. It's interesting that they can play in California, they can play in Washington, but the extra burden here, it would be impossible.
Hmm. Interesting. Mr. Byerly, are you finished, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Byerly, you want to... The question was, did this just... If you want to stay up here, Mr. Bennett, to answer any questions, you're welcome to, if anyone has any questions of you. The question was, did this all of a sudden happen now, or how long has this been enforced? Has it been sporadically enforced? What's going on here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator for the Unemployment Trust Division with the Employment Department. With me today is Rob Edwards. He's the manager of our Unemployment Trust Tax Section. And Representative Thatcher had a really good question. I'm not sure that we're just recently enforcing the statute, but the normal way we discover issues in this regard is when an unemployment insurance claim is filed and the individual that files a claim is asked, do you have any other earnings? And earnings from some of these venues show up. We don't find them in our system, so we go looking for them. We are not out auditing music venues just because we think we need to go audit music venues. So there's been no intent to go out and audit those. We are neutral on this bill and have been put in the unenviable position to enforcing 506, but we stand ready to answer other questions.
Isn't this similar to our ski lift ticket issue, kind of, sort of?
Mr. Chair, it's similar to that, yes.
Yeah, all right, I remember that well. Any questions of the department or Mr. Bennett, Representative Cameron, and then Mr. Representative Matthews?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question. You mentioned claims that would come in with other income on them. Are benefits awarded to people based on that other income?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, if it turns out that the way the work is subject, then those wages will be added into the calculation for the unemployment insurance claim, and it could make their benefits higher, yes.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So in these claims that you're talking about that triggered these audits, were those people awarded benefits based on those, based on that income, because it came underneath this statute?
That'd be correct, yes.
Yes, please, go ahead. So if we repeal this and those people apply for benefits in the future, would that income be allowed under those benefits?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, that's a good question. It would depend on the individual circumstances and whether or not they actually were independent contractors or employees. So we would look at them on a case-by-case basis under a different section of law, which would be independent contractor.
As you do now.
As correct. We would now, correct. I apologize. I can't give you a pat yes or no answer on that question.
Representative, please.
Yeah. So I just want to, I guess I'm trying to be clear here. So there, we have awarded benefits for unemployment, is what I'm hearing, in the state of Oregon to people who claimed income, and yet no unemployment taxes were paid on that income.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, if we find the wages in an audit and add them to a claim, then the employer that we find subject in that audit would pay the tax, so the benefits could be paid.
Just so I can clarify this from my own mind, that's if they're wages and it's not under a contractual agreement.
Correct.
As an independent contractor, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Representative Matthews, where did I get this Mr. thing? Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me like the venues are actually getting kind of caught up in a collateral damage type situation where somebody may have filed, where not everybody would, but some people may have arbitrarily filed for unemployment insurance. And then as a result of maybe you looking into the records, you're finding the venues that may have not paid the unemployment insurance tax, and then you're going at that. Is that kind of how this has worked out thus far?
For the record, Rob Edwards, I'm the Unemployment Insurance Tax Manager for the Employment Department. Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, that is correct.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
So in the event you do that, how much? What kind of length do you go to find out if they're independent contractors, or are we just simply looking at this language and saying they fall within the guidance of this language? We're going to enforce this today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, under advice from the Attorney General's office, when we're dealing with musicians, we're limited to looking at 657-506. We can't even apply the independent contractor criteria to those situations. The AG said, nope, 506 is very clear. The legislative intent was musicians stop at 506.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, if I could add, I think Ms. Cook did a pretty good job of characterizing what we're dealing with in these situations. I thought she did a real good job of outlining it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holby, please.
Just one real quick question about if we were to repeal this provision, what happens to the employers that have been paying taxes under this? Do they ever get any relief from this, or are they just out the money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the law would be prospective rather than retroactive, so whatever had been paid up to this point would stay in the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
And they will enjoy eternal appreciation for their generous contribution to this great state.
Mr. Chair, as all employers do.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Chair. When we find out that there's been no unemployment paid, does that also stimulate some sort of an audit into whether there's been income taxes paid and things of this nature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, it could. We currently do exchange information with our Department of Revenue, so that is a possibility, although the way that Department of Revenue chooses whom to audit is within their purview rather than ours, so I can't say with 100% certainty it would.
Representative Edwards, please.
So if, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
So moving forward, if we pass this bill and it repeals 657.506, and it's only prospective, then what about everybody that is currently, I mean, it leaves some folks in limbo, does it not? Folks who testified earlier are currently under your direction, they owe now. So, I mean, that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's correct. Yes.
If they were found to be employing someone under wages and not under an independent contractual agreement, correct?
Again, with musicians, we would not look at independent contractor under the current law.
Because it's not that way.
Right.
Well, that's interesting. And guess what, members? We are going to have independent contracting issue, I believe, before us again in a much broader conversation. So this is just a tee-up for what's coming, and it's just this narrow group of workers or business people. So anyway, we'll have a long, drawn-out conversation on all of that. I'm not trying to stifle questions. Representative Esquivel.
Chair, I might add that you're going to have a lot of participation when we open that gate.
I look forward to it. Right,
and it will come from all facets of life in the state of Oregon.
That's what we want. We want participation. We want the public process. We want to hear from the people of this great state.
And you shall, sir.
Any further questions of this nice panel? I really appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much. Okay, anyone else like to testify to this bill today? And we're not moving it today. We're waiting for a revenue impact statement. I believe we will have that on Friday. We're going to move this over to Friday. If we have it, then I intend to move the bill. I think they've made a good case, in my opinion, if we have the votes. And we'll see then. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2540 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2418.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2418 adds certain legal entities and persons affiliated with these certain legal entities to the list of parties that are exempt from real estate licensing law.
Thank you very much. John Gibson and Lori Skillman?
All those people.
I got that?
That last Skillman. Bill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Sean, come on up. Sean Gillian as well.
News business.
Whoever wants to go first, please go right ahead.
Chair Schaffler. Schaffler. Actually, my name is John Gibbon. That's two B's, no S.
Forgive me, sir.
That's fine. I'm sure you fight the same battle that I do.
Just don't let the beer get warm, and I'm a forgiving
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, I'm here today as a member of the real estate and legislative section of the real estate and land use section of the Oregon State Bar to ask your support for House Bill 2418, basically because it permits people who are domestic partners and engaged, who are domestic partners in a relationship and who are engaged in business as a limited liability company as opposed to corporations or partnerships to sell their real property through a for sale by owner mechanism. There's a provision in the licensing exemption statute for the real estate licensees in the state that covers corporations and partnerships, allows them to engage in both rental and sales activities through employees, but probably because LLCs, limited liability companies, are a late addition to our statutes, and late meaning since I've been practicing law, limited liability companies are not allowed to engage in that same activity. And it has a potential impact. I think what our concern more than anything is that people are inadvertently violating the licensing statute as it now exists, because I think most people, including myself, have always thought that limited liability companies were able to engage in all the activities that corporations and partnerships did. This has come up in the last few years. We've become aware that there's a problem with this. We'd like to see it changed. It needs to happen for both rental properties because, you know, I can give you an example of a small client of mine who's got a property, who's got an office building and a residential house on it. He's bought that through his LLC, which is a very wise business decision, protects him from the liabilities related to it beyond an acceptable limit, and theoretically he can't rent out a single family home that's next to his office building that he owns. That's something that we need to get changed. Give you another example. A few years ago, my brother and two friends bought an isolated cabin over in Eastern Oregon that they wanted to hold and keep as a recreational cabin. And I set them up as an LLC because that seemed to be the most logical way to do it. I know for a fact that cabin has not ever been on the real estate market. It's been passed down from one private owner to the next. And right at this point, I'd have to say to them that they would have a problem with selling it. And quite frankly, one of the things that makes that cabin desirable is its isolation, protects it from some vandalism, and putting it out and publicly marketing it wouldn't really be a good idea. So I believe that this is a good bill to get LLCs in the same positions as corporations and partnerships. We've done some work. The proposal to add domestic partners into the bill came from legislative counsel, in my understanding. At one point, there is a draft before you that includes limited liability partnerships and trusts. And Ms. Skillman has done some analysis on this and has been real helpful in this, and we believe now that those two items don't need to be included in the bill because there are exemptions available for them by reading the licensing statutes and the partnership statutes in LLPs and some not very clear language in the exemption statute for trusts. And I agree after the second read that her analysis on that is correct. So it's really to help out LLCs is the main reason that we're here and make them equal with other business entities.
Before we get move on, members, there are amendments. They're not here yet. We're going to see them. It's just a public hearing. But I agree with the addition of domestic partners. Matter of fact, I think we probably need to go through and rewrite the entire statute in light of that part of the law, which is a huge undertaking. Until then, we'll nickel and dime it.
Mr. Chairman, I agree. Our legislative committee has been
great.
Concerned about that, and this domestic partnership thing in relation to real estate is, of course, a big issue, and we hope that that gets done.
And I'm confident it will. I don't care which one you want to go first, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may, question about that? About your particular...
Please, if it's a question.
Is there a legal way in the state of Oregon to define the domestic partner? As there is with the spouse?
Well, I don't think we're not going to have that conversation here today. I'm just going to cut that off right there. Forgive me, Representative.
That's important. We're going to add it to the statute.
I think you're right. It is, but and I support that being added. And I think maybe we need legislative counsel to come and answer that question, not these people. And you know what, Representative? That's exactly what we're going to do. And then we'll have the right from the horse's mouth.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to ask that, and I can follow up and send
that'd
information
be great. After? I think it is. It's relevant.
Yes.
It's language in the bill, and I think the question needs to be answered. But in light of some of our civil union and civil liberties legislation from last session, and in light of what I believe is the right thing to do, it's my humble opinion, I think definitely the whole statute needs to be rewritten on who has rights and what and who's doing what and not. But yes, Representative, but I don't think these are the people that should answer that question.
Is that fair enough? Well, yeah, I'm not disagreeing whether it should be added or not. I just want to make sure that there is a definition.
And that's fair.
As there is with the spouse, there's a legal way to show that.
And when we have the next hearing, we are going to have legislative counsel sitting right there to answer that question to the best of their ability.
Perfect.
So who wants to go? Thank you. Who wants to go next? Go ahead, please.
Hi. Chair Schaffler, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. And I have been, one of my jobs at the agency is to work with people who file condominium projects with the state. One of the things that I found is that a lot of the people who file are limited liability companies. A lot of them are sole member limited liability companies. Often when people create those particular entities, they find it hard to make the distinction between them as the individual and the entity because they're the only one that owns the entity. Certainly, as I've discussed with the condominium attorneys that do these projects, it seems that there is... currently, no exemption for a sole member of a limited liability company to engage in what the statute calls professional real estate activity, which would be leasing the property, selling the property, trading the property, and so on. And certainly there needs to be an exemption for that. The issue, as Mr. Gibbons stated, from the agency's perspective, is that there are already provisions in the statute for limited liability partnerships because a different statute, which defines partnerships, clearly defines limited liability partnerships as partnerships. So that's in there, and trustees of a trust, there's already a specific provision in the real estate statutes for an exemption for those. So the only issue that we all at the table are wrestling with is the scope of the individuals within a limited liability company that would be allowed the exemption. The way that the bill currently reads is it allows a member. Let's see, it's the very last sentence of
manager
the entire
officer.
bill, it would be a member, manager, or officer of a limited liability company. The agency believes that that language is too expansive. If you had 100-member LLC, then any of the members could do it. Under this statute, there is no terminology for an officer of a limited liability company. There are only members, managing members, or managers of limited liability companies. So we wanted to narrow the scope. Parallel provision in under the statutes would be for partnerships, general partnerships. Only a individual who's a general partner of a limited partnership could engage in that activity. So we're wrestling around with managing member. The agency believes that whoever sells on behalf of the limited liability company needs to have ownership stake in the company, so that would be limited to member and so on. So what we're dealing with are some technical amendments to the bill to limit the scope. And we're working on consensus. We're real close, and we hope to have some good amendments back to the committee shortly. Thank you.
Thank you. Sean, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I've never been in a band, Mr. Chair. I just felt that was important to say.
As you're under great control, Mr.
Yes. As you've heard from my colleagues here, we are working on amendments on this. We think the principles are good in the bill. We just need to clean it up a little bit, and we hope to get back to the committee very soon with a clean bill that everyone can live with.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions of these? And we look forward to those. And I don't know what the timeline is, but as soon as we get them, we'll run around the flagpole. Any Representative Campbell?
Yeah, thank you. And just to, as somebody with experience in selling or transferring real estate as a member of an LLC or a managing member of an LLC, a bank usually typically is going to ask for articles that give that person permission to do that. So, be careful on how we structure amendments that would eliminate a member. Now you have to turn that member into a managing member to give him or her permission to change a real estate transaction. When just be careful as you go forward with these amendments and how you restrict possibly how LLCs might do their business.
And Representative, that life and business experience is incredibly invaluable to this committee, and I share his concerns. So go forth and do good. Any further questions of these nice people? All right. Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2418? Oh, Ms. Grady, would you like to come up and...
Yep.
Okay. Come back when the...
We have testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. All right. Seeing no one else, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2418 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5-4.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 54 modifies required language in weekly certified payroll reports for projects that are covered under Oregon's prevailing wage law from actual wages paid to gross wages earned. The bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and also passed unanimously out of the Senate.
Man, I don't even know why they need us to work on it if the Senate has been unanimous. Ms. Hammond, would you like to come on up and shed some light on us House members on this bill?
No one else laughed, Mr. Chair, but I think you're kind of funny today.
Hey, we do our best, Representative. Laugh, and the
Thank
world
you.
Laughs with you.
Good morning, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industry. And the committee administrator is correct. This bill is really a technical fix identified by Boley staff to address language existing in the statute that currently requires that certified payrolls that are required to be submitted on public works projects subject to the prevailing wage rate law report wages paid the preceding week. By way of background, the prevailing wage rate law requires all contractors to file certified payroll records with a public agency reporting hours worked by employees, the classifications of workers, fringe benefits paid, and other issues relating to payroll information. The law requires that these payrolls be submitted for each week a worker is employed on a public work, but the way the statute's written, it assumes that the contractor pays its workers on a weekly basis, which is not required under the law. The language currently requires contractors to report actual wages paid, and we are proposing that that language be amended to read gross wages earned, so that employers with non-weekly pay periods don't need to conform their payroll practices to the certified payroll filing requirements. This concept was reviewed by the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and as the committee administrator noted, the Senate passed the bill on February 4th with a unanimous vote.
Thank you. Any question to Ms. Hammond? Well, good work. Would anyone else like to testify to this bill? Oh, Representative Holby.
Thank you. Christy, what's the penalty for a contractor who falsifies a certified statement?
Chair Schauffler, Representative Holby, the penalty is up to $5,000 per violation.
Thank you.
And then now you pick my head. What's a violation? I mean, how many can you? You could probably have a whole bunch, couldn't you?
Chair Schauffler, if a contractor falsifies their payroll records, that's a violation. It reports information incorrectly on their payroll records, that is a violation.
So every one record they submit?
Yes.
So
stands alone.
There's a record for each individual employee, correct?
Actually, it's a certified payroll document where all the workers employed are listed, the number of hours worked are listed, the pay rates are listed. So anytime information on one of those payroll filings is falsified, that would constitute a violation under the prevailing wage rate law.
My question is, if you have 100 employees and you falsify on each one of those employees, would each one of those be a violation?
Yes, Chair Schauffler,
yeah,
it would.
Representative Holby.
A follow-up. So at what point do those violations add up to where a contractor would be barred from performing prevailing public works projects?
Chair Schauffler, Representative Holby, currently there is not a debarment penalty for falsification of certified payroll records. The only grounds by which an employer can be debarred from public contracting is intentionally failing to pay the prevailing wage rate or intentional failure to post the prevailing wage rates on a project. However, there is another bill which we've submitted this session which would make intentional failure to file certified payroll or intentional falsification of certified payroll records a deborable offense, and that is a separate concept.
I think it's a concept that has merit, my humble opinion. Any more questions of Ms. Hammond today? Thank you, Christine. Anyone else like to testify to this bill out there? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5-4. I'm going to open work session on Senate Bill 5-4.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 54 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 54 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Thatcher.
I just wanted to throw my two cents that good. This would make it easier.
Good.
It would make it a lot easier.
It's that life and work experience that we need, and thank you for putting that in there.
And I do want to say that this law is very, very complicated, and it is very easy to make mistakes. So
we want to be careful, Representative, on not being too draconian on innocent people.
That is right.
And you know, I agree. It's a delicate balancing act. And good, legitimate people out there that are doing the right thing and trying to do the right thing and want to comply, I would not want to punish. But bums and bustards and evildoers, we want to bust them. So with that, is there any opposition to this bill on the committee today?
Bum or a buster.
Well, seeing none, so move.
My name was Buster.
I said bustard.
Oh.
So, would someone, Representative Holby, you want to carry this bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
We represent, in fact,
Mr. Chair,
forgive
I think
me.
There's somebody who wanted
consent?
Want a consent calendar?
I mean,
is that a motion, Representative?
I move that we put this on the consent calendar.
Representative Edwards moves that we place Senate Bill 54 on the consent calendar. Is any concern?
Well, I just am kind of hurt that people wouldn't want to listen to me, but...
We all want to listen to you, Representative.
No, I'm just...
All right, well, seeing no opposition, then so moved. Is there anything else for the good of the order today? And we are...